We hope you enjoyed listening to the Toledo, Ohio enthusiast, Denver, Colorado.
Welcome to Cyber Squid Radio, an up-and-coming podcast where we discuss the latest science news and science-related pop culture we think matters most to you. I'm Jeff Stevenson, a science communicator based here in Toledo, Ohio.
And I'm Logan Shear, a chef and science enthusiast based in Denver, Colorado. Today, we sit down with Cy Montgomery, naturalist and author of the book, The Soul of an Octopus.
Now, is it octopuses or octopi?
What does it even mean to be conscious?
Do you think octopuses have dreams?
All that and more on this week's episode of Cyber Squid Radio.
I know what you mean when you say you can't explain. I know you got it wrong. That's the way you play the game.
Cy, welcome to the show. We're so happy to have you.
And I'm so happy to be on Cyber Squid.
I know it's not an octopus, but we are members of the cephalopod family.
That's yes, right. Exactly. Go Ceph. Ceph rule.
Why don't you start off by just giving us a very brief summary of your book?
It was 3 years of being continuously surprised and delighted by my friendships with octopuses and what they showed me about consciousness and thinking and feeling.
Logan, I don't know about you, but I am getting a very surreal moment because, as we mentioned before we started recording, Logan and I both listened to the audiobook and your voice is just spot on, the exact same. And I'm like, wait, am I listening to the audiobook still or am I talking with Cy Montgomery? Do I just keep listening?
I love that. That's wonderful because I mean, that's what you really want. That's what you really want when you're reading your book to somebody. I mean, I realized when I was doing the audiobook that I was reading this to real people, and I love it that I sound the same when I was reading to you as when I was speaking to you.
So octopuses, not octopi, as you mentioned within your first few minutes of your audiobook. You can't take a Greek word like octopus and put a Latin suffix on it, like I. It would be octopuses, that's correct.
Well, I mean, you can do that, Logan. I mean, you can do it.
Well, you can.
No one's going to arrest
you.
All
the time, but...
but when you go to the octopus conferences and symposia, you will not be happy because they'll whack you. They'll whack you with a wet herring.
Which they carry with them.
Their food of choice.
They carry a wet herring with them at all times. That's
of course.
Well, I would, wouldn't you?
Well, if I was interacting with, you know, eight armed organisms every day, I certainly would.
That's right. It's very handy.
Have you always been interested in octopuses, or what inspired you first to get onto this topic?
Well, yes, I have always been interested in octopuses, but what really got me inspired was all the other books I've done. I've done like 22 other books, and they've all been, almost all of them have been on vertebrate animals, and most of them animals who live on land. Mm-hmm. And all these years of writing about animals who, like us, live on land and have skeletons, made me really wonder about not just the rest of life, but most of life on this earth. Most of the animal life on this earth is invertebrates who live in the ocean. Oh. And here I was calling myself a naturalist, and I didn't even know most of the animal life on this planet. So I really wanted to get to know somebody who represented this extremely large group. And I think it really took me this long and this number of books to get to the point where I could even tackle the idea of becoming friends with someone so unlike us,
right,
that you'd have to go into science fiction or outer space to find a creature more different. Mm-hmm. And yet I found you can be friends with an octopus, and that they do possess an intelligence that's uncannily like ours.
Yeah.
And this really changed my understanding about what it feels like to think and to know, and what the nature of the mind, not just my mind or your mind, but the mind might be.
Yeah. Would you describe for us your first encounter you had with an octopus? What was that like?
Oh, I'm delighted to, because it is so vivid. It's to this day so vivid. The first time I went was in March of 2011. And one of the, it was Scott Dowd, actually, who's the head of the Freshwater Gallery at New England Aquarium, opened the lid to a tank of the giant Pacific octopus. She was a female named Athena. And immediately she turned bright red with excitement. And she came just floating over to us from her lair. And her arms came boiling up out of the water. And the next thing I knew, my arms were plunging into the water. And even though it was cold, and even though she, of course, was slimy, and even though, according to a lot of the literature and myths about octopuses, these scary monsters, I was absolutely elated to find that my hands and arms were being covered with dozens and then hundreds of these creamy white grasping suckers that were leaving marks on my arms that looked exactly like hickeys that I was going to have to explain to my husband when I got home. But I was thrilled because she was just as curious about me as I was about her. And I felt that right there and then, we had had a meeting of the minds across this incredible chasm of half a billion years of evolution.
We hope you're enjoying the interview so far. Once again, we have a giveaway today for our listeners. Cy Montgomery gifted a copy of her book to one of you. We are going to randomly pick a member from our Facebook fan page. So if you don't already like and follow the page, today is the day to do it. You'll be automatically entered into the contest. Just search for us on Facebook or go to facebook.com/cybersquidradio.
Something that is so unlikely that they don't share our environment just as we don't share theirs. I mean, we would die if we went to meet each other naturally, but you're able to experience this at the aquarium and you can find you're bridging this gap into what you're saying is meeting another conscious mind, interacting with something that is trying to understand you just as much as you are trying to understand it.
Exactly. Using, of course, very different senses and a very different body. I mean, as you know, the octopus brain, you wouldn't even know it was a brain if you saw it lying on a table instead of like our brain and mammalian brains that kind of look like a nut in its shell, like a walnut in its shell. Their brain is a ring around the throat, and instead of four lobes like ours, they have between 50 and 75 lobes. And three-fifths of their neurons are not even in their brain, but in their arms. And they can taste with their skin. You know, they can pour their bodies through the tiniest little opening. They can melt into the tiniest little crack. Their eyes are very like ours, but they came to have those eyes through a totally different route than we came to have our eyes. And they even, you know, their whole body plan, our body goes head, body, limbs. They go body, head, limbs. Everybody thinks the octopus's head is what we would think of as the torso, where the organs are. It's not mm-hmm. their head. That's a totally different body part with like their digestive and reproductive organs and their gills and stuff in there. They just have such different lives, and they go through the ocean experiencing things in such a different way. So for this reason, I was stunned and thrilled to see I could make somebody like that my friend.
Now, with the history of octopuses being what it is from the first descriptions from Pliny the Elder being, I believe you mentioned Pliny did that, right, in your book?
Yes. I mean, nobody was a fan of
them. Yeah, I mean, they're horrifying. If you were to see one, just and you're out swimming in the ocean. I mean, the ocean's got a lot of scary stuff, which is why I don't particularly want to go diving or anything like that.
True.
I'd rather be behind plate glass, and that, I'll experience it that way. Thank you very much. But you do such a great job of describing their motivations and anthropomorphizing them in a way that really makes you feel connected within your book. I mean, I was sucked in within the first 5 minutes of your book.
So to speak.
Right. Pun not intended.
It's the nature of the book topic, Logan.
Yes.
Well, thank
I mean,
you.
You describe their head as being as soft as custard. but they could easily overpower a man because they're made almost entirely up of muscle with 1,600 suckers in the case of the great Pacific octopus. And whereas before, I've seen them, I work as a chef, and I've seen them as mainly a menu item, if I'm honest with you. I have a couple of frozen octopuses
at
the restaurant.
Yeah, no one's at their best as a menu item.
Where now I feel a little bad.
The plate adds 10 pounds.
I actually reached out to the Denver Aquarium in preparation for doing this, and I've been emailing their aquarist and resident who deals with their octopuses because I want to go down and I want to have the same experience that you had meeting one and touching this octopus and getting to know them as another being and not just something to be scared of in the ocean.
Oh, that's wonderful. I hope you let me know. Will you email me and let me know how that goes when you have that experience? Because I would love to hear. The one thing I would say is, make sure your hand doesn't get too close to the middle of the octopus in the beak, and you'll be fine. And with a giant Pacific, because they have such long arms, you won't have to worry about it. If you were dealing with a teeny tiny octopus, well, like the red octopus, it's not the tiniest octopus, but the red octopus is so small that you're always close to his beak. And it's not that they want to hurt you. It's just that it would freak out the aquarium if you got bitten.
Yeah. Legal and everything.
Right, right. But yeah, I think you will love it.
I'm excited.
In your book, you have just so much information. Clearly, not only did you learn from the aquarium and the staff there, but you've obviously been doing a lot of your own research as two, you know, lay cephalopod heads over here, cephaloheads, if you would. What's the most interesting?
Call our listeners squidlings.
Yeah. What's the most interesting trivia that you think you could give us about octopuses?
I know, she wrote a whole book about it.
Wow, where do you start? Well, they can taste with all of their skin, including their eyelids, that they can pour their boneless bodies through a tiny opening. A 100-pound octopus can squeeze through an opening smaller than an orange. That their arms will continue to do stuff even if they are severed. I've even read that the arms can hunt and catch prey when they are severed. Octopus sex is always a good subject.
Oh, yeah. I want to hear about that. Yeah. let's dive into this.
I got to spend Valentine's Day one year, not with my beloved husband, alas, but watching two octopus have sex in Seattle.
Interesting.
And as I was describing this to my friend, as we were traveling on a train to New York, it was one of those, you know, business trains full of guys with briefcases and nice suits and stuff. And when I started describing what I'd seen, it was a noisy, chatty car. But then we quickly noticed it had grown completely silent. And as I was saying things like, you know, and then they flew into each other's arms, mouth to mouth, covered with suckers. And he changed color. And then, I mean, it is really...
Now, these people don't know that you're talking about an octopus at this point on Valentine's Day.
Maybe when I started talking about all the suckers they did. But, wow, I mean, six hearts beating as one. Uh-huh. And every inch of your skin, not just feeling and touching, but tasting. And being able to change color and pattern and shape while you're making love. But their lovemaking has been described in a less than sexy way by no less than Aristotle, who said he admits his arm into her nostril. No, he admits his, I think he said he has a sort of penis on his arm that he admits to her nostril, which sounds really unappealing.
Right.
But...
Depends what you're into, Cy, all right?
don't they pass, or is this cuttlefish I'm thinking of? Or do they pass like a little packet of sperm at the end? I always thought it was very formal and bow tie wearing, where it was like, and here's this for you, madam, and then good day.
Well, you know what? It can be, because there's a kind of, they have sex in different positions like we do, I guess, but one thing they do is called distance mating. And because mating might involve a literal dinner date in which one of them eats the other, the male has to be very careful sometimes. And there is a distance mating in which one octopus can actually still stay in his lair and kind of pass the sperm packet to the female in her lair. And the thing is, he does have to pass it with his specialized arm that is just made for that occasion. And if you stay in your lair and just pass the packet, you won't get killed, but you can have your special arm
just lopped right off.
Oh.
However, the good news is you can grow a new one.
Oh, well, good.
Oh, well, that's convenient.
Mother Nature looking out for those those poor bullied male octopi. Octopuses. Oh, my gosh. It's so natural.
It's like a long distance.
Here comes the herring.
It's like a long distance relationship, you know, just like, hey.
Which I think
like
it would
Skype
prefer
dating.
If those were the options.
Yeah.
Swipe right?
Yeah.
Swipe left. Or just swipe off the entire ligula.
So,
never mind.
Being as intelligent as they are octopuses trainable? Can you housebreak them? Can they play fetch?
They sort of will play fetch. I mean, they have been documented by two scientists playing with a ball.
Okay.
Essentially bouncing a ball against a wall like a kid playing basketball. They did this by throwing a Tylenol extra strength painkiller bottle into the jet created by their filter so that it would circle back to them, and then they'd throw it back in again, it would circle back to them. The thing is, and there are octopuses. There was one in New Zealand who would take photographs of visitors.
I do remember you mentioning
that. Or she would put her arm into this little hole that had the trigger for a camera, you know, that you snap a picture and press that little button to take the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And you could pretty much count on the octopus to do that when you offered it. But the thing is, they want to do what they want to do. And if the thing that you're asking them to do just doesn't interest them at that moment, you're just out of luck. Those are smarter than we are.
So I can't go in with like a fish and train it to go through a loop if I were like a trainer, like some sort of aquatic mammal or aquatic cephalopod trainer.
I don't know if anyone has actually tried to do that. If you can make it worth their while, they'll do it.
Right. And I think in that way, they're much like cats.
Yeah. That's true. Training cats, I have heard, is more difficult than training tigers.
I'm not surprised.
Tigers are actually pretty easy to train, I've heard, but not
Yeah, they just don't care.
Cats.
I have three, and the only thing they're good at is catching bugs. That's their only job.
Well, this kind of brings me to, you mentioned this very briefly in your book, and I was hoping that maybe you could dive into it a little bit more in this podcast, but you mentioned the phrase, the theory of mind. And how the octopuses relate to this. Could you elaborate on that a little further to explain to our audience what the theory of mind is?
Yeah, theory of mind is thought to be one of the attributes of a higher mind. And what it is the ability to develop a theory or a belief about what another mind might be thinking. I'm sitting next to you and I'm eating a bowl of spaghetti and you're eating a bowl of spaghetti. I'm liking my bowl of spaghetti, but you're not liking yours. That's impossible, it is thought, for some organisms to do. They have to believe. In fact, this is true of small children. If they like what they're eating and you're eating the same thing, they really can't conceive of the idea that you don't like it.
Yeah.
So it's the idea of thinking, putting yourself in the mind of another animal.
Right.
Or another person.
And that's interspecies or cross species, too.
Right, exactly. So we try to do this with other humans. You try to pick out the perfect birthday present. You try to ask someone out on a date who is going to say yes. You know, and we fail at this sometimes, but at least we are able to conceive of the idea that someone might be thinking something different from what you're thinking and imagine what it is that's on their mind. Now, why do we think octopuses can do this? Because octopuses have to catch prey and have to escape predators of so many different kinds that they have to imagine, like, okay, that dolphin that wants to eat me, he's going to want to do this. Whereas this clam that I want to open, he's going to want to do this. I'm going to have to get away from this predator, so maybe I better jet away this way. Oop, that's not working. Maybe I'll change color. Ah, that didn't work. Better shoot some ink.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you have to be really kind of fast on your feet mentally and imagine what the other mind is going to do.
And I think that's actually a similar concept to the way they think humans evolved intelligence as well, is, you know, either from constantly having to be in the hunter-gatherer situation of working with other people and communicating, and, you know, language has really been our best tool, or even if you go further back, the act of having to swing from branch to branch and make the intelligent decision of, like, where am I moving versus where my tribe is moving, and what is the next thing that I have to grab, and just having that dexterity and quick ability to make decisions.
And it has often been alleged that our intelligence was sculpted by the fact that we're a social species. And so people have been so confounded by octopuses, who in some cases, I mean, there's over 250 different species of octopus, but most of them do not appear to be very social. So everyone's been left wondering, like, well, what do they use their intelligence for if it's not to be social? But in a way, they're hypersocial because they are hanging out with so many different kinds of creatures, not just different individuals of their own kind. And
you
so,
mentioned that story of a starfish in your book that shared the tank with Athena.
That's right. And Athena, actually, that starfish, he was a sunflower sea star, and he was still there with Octavia as well. And Octavia had some interactions with him. It was a male. We knew he was a male. She had laid eggs, and whenever that sunflower sea star would go near her eggs, she would go fend him off. And even though he didn't have a brain, he is not stupid. And he knew an octopus was coming after him. So he would back
Right.
You believe that octopuses are these conscious creatures then, right?
I absolutely feel if I am conscious, they are conscious.
Right.
Well, how do you know that you're not just mirroring and anthropomorphizing yourself onto this creature that may just be reacting the same way chemical reactions happen in that starfish or in some other lesser-brained animal?
Well, one reason that I don't think I'm just pushing my own feelings onto the animal is that the octopuses would constantly do things that I wasn't anticipating. Another is that when you look at the neurochemistry of the human brain, which we know pretty well, we know that in certain emotions, for example, you get a spike in certain neurotransmitters. When we give birth to our children, when we make love, when we have social contacts with others who we love, for example, this is just one example, we have a spike in the hormone oxytocin.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Every single one of these neurochemicals that we know to exist in humans to be important in different kinds of emotions, every single one of them, we have found a version of it in every other animal we've looked for it in, particularly octopuses. Hmm. And octopuses, they have something that's so like oxytocin, we call it cephalotocin. And what is amazing is that with us, you know, this spikes when we give birth, when we nurse our children, but also in other social situations. Octopuses lay eggs. They don't give birth. They only get to see their young hatch right before they'll actually use their jets to help give their babies kind of a leg up into the ocean, blowing them out of the lair into the ocean waves where they will become part of the plankton that keeps the world alive. And yet, this animal has a version of oxytocin. And same with every other thing. You've heard of cortisol, the stress hormone. They have cortisol, absolutely. And this is not my observation. I am quoting Jennifer Mather, who's a very well-known psychologist at University of Lethbridge in Canada. And whenever she gets accused of anthropomorphizing anything, what she says is this great phrase that I keep in my back pocket next to the herring that I slap people with, and it is, neurotransmitters are highly conserved across taxa, and that should shut them up. And what that means is...
Wait, explain that a little further for me.
Yeah.
For, you know, for the audience, not because I don't understand, but, you know, because the audience needs to be kept up.
That we have the exact same neural substrate, really, as the rest of animal life.
Right.
And that it makes sense. It also makes evolutionary sense. I mean, when you look at it, our ability to think, to feel, and to know has enormous survival value.
Absolutely.
And it does, too, for an octopus, as it does for a fish, as it does for a dog, as it does for a mouse. And I think that the greater sin, far worse than projecting our feelings onto another person or animal, which, of course, is easy to do. I mean, how many times have you gone to pet a cat that just, you know, swiped you with his paw?
Right.
But far worse than pretending, you know, than projecting your emotions onto another animal is to pretend that they don't have any at all. I think that's when you run into real trouble. Because then
point.
You have no idea who you're dealing with. And also, morally, you run into trouble. Then you start to behave like Rene Descartes, who conducted vivisection on animals with no anesthetic. And as they were shrieking and howling in pain, he told his students, oh, it's just like a clock making a noise.
Right.
Man, you don't want to go there.
It's an instinctual response, not that they're actually experiencing pain.
I'm kind of under the mindset, after listening to you, that maybe it's not about that we are putting some sort of special onus on this octopus or some other intelligent animal, but that we may think a little too highly of ourselves.
Right.
We're much more like other organisms rather than saying like, oh, we are the pinnacle of consciousness. And how am I supposed to say that that is like me? It's more like, well, we're an organism that obviously feels this way. It's pretty easy to understand that the way the chemicals work in our brains, the way that we interact, the way that we feel, that other organisms are also going to behave this way. And this might be the norm, consciousness, as opposed to some unique thing humans have cornered the market on.
Historically, humans are notoriously egocentric.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the whole idea that emotions belong to humans alone. Every time we have tried to find that Rubicon that separates us from the rest of animate creation, further scientific discovery has shown it to be false. From tool use, you know, I was born in 1958. Jane Goodall went into the field in 1960. And in her first few months, discovered that chimpanzees use tools. We now know that birds, fish, and insects also use tools. It does not separate us from the rest of creation. There are some people who say that, oh, language is the thing that separates us from the rest of animate creation. Well, not true at all. Kahn's, I'm going to mess up his last name, but there's a wonderful researcher who has discovered that prairie dogs have a very complex language. Parrots, as Dr. Irene Pepperberg has shown us, will speak to us in our own language. They will speak to us in perfect English, meaningfully telling us what they want, sometimes lying to us, sometimes playing jokes on us, but telling us exactly what's the difference between this and that. Oh, this is a blue triangle. That is a green circle. They'll say sentences like this to us
right.
in English.
Oh, and they'll lie.
You know, whatever. What's that?
They'll lie. Don't.
Yes.
You mentioned in your book, parrots will actually try and deceive you.
Oh, yeah. They will try to deceive you. And that's another thing that people have tried to say, oh, like only humans will try to deceive others. That's not true at all. Animals frequently attempt to deceive others. And guess who is great at that? Our friend the octopus, who can look like anything they want. We think of octopuses as camouflaging so that they look like the background and you can't see them. Well, they can do that for sure. But what they also can do is look like something else. They can look like a bunch of sea snakes. They can look like a poisonous flatfish. They can look like a passing cloud. They can look like a much bigger animal. They can look like they have eyes all over their bodies. They can look like anything they want. So they are fabulous at deceiving others, which is, again, thought to be a property of higher minds.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you have to be able to realize what you're doing in order to project yourself to the outside world or to predators.
Right. If you're going to confuse someone, you have to understand they have a mind to confuse and imagine what it's like. What am I going to look like to this other animal? Oh, I don't want to disguise myself as a bowl of cereal to a person, because then they're going to want to eat me.
Exactly.
You know? Instead, I'll look like a poisonous flatfish.
Yeah. You know, it made me so sad when I was listening to your audiobook and realized that even the giant Pacific octopus has such a short lifespan, something that is as intricate and as beautiful to be made by nature like this, it only exists for at most 5 or 6 years.
I know. And I'm now, I'm not waiting for this, but I'm dreading the day that the current octopus, whose name is Sai, last day, because she just laid eggs a couple of months ago, and one of these days, I'm going to get the news that Sai has died. What is happy is when you walk through the aquarium and you hear people saying, "Oh, Sai is so beautiful. Sai is so large. Sai is so flexible." These are things that I don't normally hear, but I can hear them when I go to the aquarium because I have an octopus named after me.
Yeah. And what aquarium is
that's
at?
Great.
This is New England Aquarium, where I met all the octopuses, all the captive octopuses, except for Squirt and Rain, whose Valentine's Day octopus blind date I described in Seattle. But all of the captive octopuses in the book lived at the New England Aquarium.
Well, I think you need to send us some photos of Sai for us to post on our Facebook and our Twitter page so that we can
probably
be celebrating Sai.
Oh, okay, yeah. I'm happy to. I can send a picture of the two Sais if you want.
Awesome.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that would be even better.
Compare and contrast.
Sai and Sai Jr.
Yeah, that's right.
So have you entirely given up seafood since writing this book? Are you a vegetarian now after describing the conscious mind?
Well, I have been vegetarian. I've been vegetarian for 30 years, actually.
Oh, I see.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. As a naturalist, I suppose that makes sense.
Probably wouldn't have wanted to eat octopus even before that. Because, you know, I think a lot of us who've looked at octopuses in aquaria have the same experience. You often feel that the animal is looking back at you. You know, and that's the case sometimes with fish as well. But it's so easy to see it in octopus. Just because you can't see an animal looking back at you doesn't mean that it's unintelligent, or that it doesn't regard you, or even if it doesn't regard you, doesn't mean it's unintelligent, of course. But I think a lot of people who watch octopuses kind of know. We have that extra sense when there's someone in there, you know?
Right.
And I'd always kind of felt that about them. And I'd wanted to write this book for a long time, but I was not yet ready. And finally, I was. And It was the time to write this book because, you know, I'm not even sure that readers were ready to read this book before when it was published in 2015.
Well, it was a fantastic read, Sai. Thank you so much for sharing that project with the world itself and then coming on our podcast and talking about it for a short while. We really appreciate it.
Oh gosh! Well, how could I not want to be on Cyber Squid? This is a real pleasure.
Jeff and I would like to thank you all for listening today.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this interview as much as we enjoyed participating in it.
We assume that if you are on this end of the podcast, you're one of the cadre of fans that really enjoy what Jeff and I are trying to do here, which is share science with the world.
I included a link in the show notes that makes it as easy as 2 clicks to drop a review into our iTunes page.
This really helps out our show, so thank you in advance. We'll see you here next time on CyberSquid Radio.